Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello again, everybody, and thanks for joining us for another Motorsport Magazine podcast on a beautiful day in London as we gather in the Motorsport headquarters by the River Thames. And of course, we're going to review the Grand Prix season, and what a season it was. Around the table, we have a glittering array of talent. Possibly this amount of talent has never been gathered in one place at one time before, I may suggest. Hundreds of years of experience around this table.
Not since the last time we did this, you mean.
Thank you very much, Nigel. And somebody, here comes Ed Foster, our website editor. Anyway, on with the show. In no particular order, we have with us today Mark Hughes, Nigel Roebuck, Simon Aaron, and of course, our editor, Damien Smith. And I think we start, obviously, we have to start with the dominance of Mercedes-Benz. Extraordinary season, which I guess, Mark, really began last winter, didn't it? Or even before?
Even before. They had a single-cylinder prototype running midway through 2010, which were the good year and a half ahead of everyone on the engine program alone. Yeah. Followed on from that to have a big engine advantage, something in the region of 70 horsepower, and the way it was laid out, the chassis team were able to take advantage of it in a fairly unique way.
When Nicky convinced Hamilton to join the team, I wonder how much he could tell Lewis at that stage about what they had up their sleeve.
Yeah, he says he got the full rundown from Braun. He said although Nicky was came along at the right time to swing it, he said he's the big thing that really convinced him was the rundown of what they were doing from Ross Braun. I'm sure Ross will have filled them in exactly what they were doing and why he thought they were going to have an advantage. And he's the sort of guy you believe when he talks. So yeah,
absolutely. It's interesting actually. Now Lewis is sort of appearing to stress that no, it wasn't Nicky, it was Ross. I mean, he was on about it the weekend, wasn't he, about Ross coming to his mother's house to persuade him. So it was very easy to forget Ross last weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But unfortunately,
as Mark's written in his season review, which is on sale now, Ross, this is a fourth different team for Ross to be a champion. It's his championship as much as it is anyone's.
Absolutely,
isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I mean, he pulled together the whole structure of the thing. Him and Andy Cowell at Mercedes HPP, they pulled everything together and integrated in a unique way, in a way that even Ferrari, who's got everything on the same site, didn't manage to do. And they were very aware of what they were doing and what they were trying to do. And absolutely, you couldn't say that this wasn't a proper Ross championship, because all the foundations were laid for the season before.
And you had the benefit of wandering off to go fishing and watching the rest of them sort out the driver politics. It's a perfect position to be in,
absolutely.
I thought.
Actually, that's something I must say. I've wondered several times through the year, if Ross had still been there, how differently would this have been handled? Particularly Spa, which I thought was farcical. But I think Ross had been there, that would have been quite a different scenario.
And that brings us on to three of our readers have got questions on each of these topics, by the way. And John McGregor wants to know, or surmises, how bad would it have been the 2014 season if Mercedes had implemented team orders and not, you know, not let Nico and Lewis race?
Yeah, it would have been like 92, something like that. It would have been one guy in one car winning everything. It would have been dreadful. So, yeah, kudos.
Instead, we got 88, didn't we?
Basically. Exactly, yeah.
Okay, Jonathan Abbott wants to know that, well, he doesn't want to know. He says that in years to come, with the benefit of hindsight, people may look back on this season and say it was inevitable that Hamilton would beat Rosberg to the title. Nigel, I wondered, you know, did we all think it was inevitable that he'd get the upper hand in the end, do you think?
I didn't think it was inevitable, no. Simply because I could see them coming at it different ways, but it did very much remind me of sort of Senna Prost situation with because you know Nico is so bright and spends a lot of his time thinking, you know, about how do I improve, on terms of speed, you know, obviously Nico was going to have the upper hand.
Although he did out qualify. Hamilton many times, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, and that's the most impressive facet of his season because, and the way he did it as well. Typically, you'd see him through the weekend, looking as though he was two or three tenths behind, and all he was doing was working away at perfection, chipping away, and then he would just produce the lap. He put all the bits together that he'd been building through the weekend at the crucial time. Whereas Lewis would get a balance he more or less could live with, and then just drive it, and in the perfection of one lap, the getting a car perfect for one lap, Nico's been brilliant. He's not only been fantastic at getting the setup right, but then just unleashing everything and delivering on that one lap. It's when you get the more improvisational skills needed during a race, or as the fuel load comes down, as the tyres wear, as the track temperature changes, that's when we've seen typically Lewis hold the speed advantage over Nico.
It's interesting that, isn't it?
I was going to say the other thing that impressed me about Nico, apart from the pole thing, was that performance in Canada, which I thought was way better than any of his victories.
That was
sensational, the way he managed the car in 160 brake horsepower down and was still driving it as, you know.
It's quite interesting that without the 160 horsepower, he's doing similar lap times to a McLaren with the electrical.
Yes, it was.
Quite depressing if you're a McLaren, I'd say.
Paddy Lowe said to me after that race, if Nico does win the championship in the end, he'll deserve it just on the basis of this race.
And not only was he setting fastest sector times in the first sector, but he was consistently very, very fast at the DRS detection points, so that the other guy, I think it was a Force India behind him at the time, was couldn't get DRS on him. So all he had to do every lap was make sure he was out of DRS reach, and he did that every single time.
Ian Bannister says that Alonso and Vettel, like their number two drivers, kept on a tight leash. I think we've certainly seen evidence of that. So he asks, does Lewis Hamilton deserve some extra kudos for not demanding that he has a subjugated number two driver and that he gets all the best kit and all the, you know?
I'm struggling to understand the comparison with Alonso and Vettel, since Alonso consummately had the better of his teammate and Vettel was constantly blown away.
I think what he's saying is that their number twos, they are categorically number one.
Well, I don't think Kimi was a sort of, you know, poor little, you know, hampered number two who wasn't allowed to challenge Fernando. Do you? Does anybody?
I don't, but I'm
mean,
not.
I mean, if that was the case, he did it extremely convincingly.
Quite.
By not being in the same vicinity.
Yeah, that was very good. He disguised that well. But no, I take the point. But Alonso done it on pure performance alone. He wouldn't have needed any contractual help. But I take the point. And it's certainly one of the things that we hear Fernando was demanding in his negotiations with Ferrari to continue was veto over the second driver, choice of technical personnel, things like that. He does prefer it to be all around him, and when it wasn't at McLaren, there was a certain fallout, and even the rare occasions when Fisichella got in front of him at Renault. He was
not pleased
on the radio. But as for kudos for not doing that, it's just a different way of doing it. It's not something that Lewis isn't made up that way. He's not somebody that has that hard edge off the track. I don't think that some of the greats have had. And he just, his default is just how fast he believes himself to be.
Lewis isn't that way, and I don't think the team is built up that way, is it, either?
No, it's not.
With the management it's got. So.
No, it's not. It's true.
But actually, Rob Smedley made a good point when I was talking to him towards the end of the year about their situation, his and Massa's, at Ferrari with Fernando. And I asked him if he'd resented that, and he said absolutely not, because he said all the power Fernando had, he earned. And he said, and if you don't produce week after week after week after week, if you stop producing, your power's gone. You get forgotten very quickly. So he said, you can say about Michael, you can say it about Ayrton, that status they have, that power they have within a team, is something that just comes naturally with their, the strength of their.
Yeah, they choose to use it, but you have to be good enough to be able to.
That's right. Otherwise, you just carry that power.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think we saw this year with a string of mostly fifth and sixth places with Fernando. I mean, that was in a Routemaster bus, effectively. I mean, it was just a fabulous. I mean, it doesn't show in the results, but he again was one of the year's star performers to me.
I think it was the most depressing sight of the season was Alonso trying to pass Will Stevens in a Caterham.
asking who it was.
Yes,
just a bit like David Purley saying, "Who's the bloke in the red car behind me?" the other way around.
After the race at Silverstone, we're in the Alonso conference, and someone said, "You know, was this the best you could have done today?" He said, "If I'd started last on the grid, I could have finished sixth. If I'd started on pole, I could have finished sixth." Yes, that's pretty much, that's where it was.
Okay, let's move on because there's so much to talk about. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but we have to have a look at the financial crisis, for want of a better phrase, that's happening in Grand Prix racing at the moment. Mark, how did we get to this point?
We give the rights away to Bernie for 100 years, and he sold them on to a private equity company who continue to just rape the sport, which is what's happening now.
Take all the money?
Take a big chunk of the money. And also what happened, another major part of it, was how big the big teams became in the boom years, quadrupled in size. And they're now too big for the economy. And they still need to be fed as if there were big teams in boom time economics. So that money is not being taken out of the sport is being given to them to keep them at that level, at that size. And the smaller teams can go sink.
I suppose the thing is that what really matters is the future, not the past. So, I mean, what briefly is the answer to this? Is it three-car teams? Is it the big team sharing out the money more equitably? I mean, where are we going from here?
The short-term solution should be the big teams sharing out more equitably. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to get three-car teams either the way it is at the moment, although if two teams disappear, well, maybe we'll have to see third Ferrari, third Red Bull, third Mercedes. But there is no. It seems to me, don't know about you, Nigel, but there doesn't seem to be a long-term plan that they're working towards to correct this crisis.
Well,
it seems to me it's going to be.
There's absolutely no evidence, is there?
It seems to me it's going to be corrected by a serious crisis and fall down and having to rebuild.
It is utterly. However you dress it up, I don't know the precise figure for F1's annual income from trackside advertising, race hosting fees, TV deals and so on, but I think it's about $1.8 billion. And if that kind of income can't sustain 11 racing teams, it's kind of preposterous, isn't it?
It sure is, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely it is. I mean, I entirely agree with Mark that the big team should give up a little, and they won't. He's right, I can't see that happening. But I also think, you know, somebody should fleece CVC a little as well, because, I mean, they've just been on such a roll for years and years and years. Just the rape is the right word, as Mark said.
The thing is, there's just no incentive, because we know Formula One is not a utopian society. We know from the predictable failure of the Formula One Teams Association, you know, the teams are completely competitive entities out for their own ends without caring about any sort of bigger picture. And CVC, well, they're not going to be around for much longer, are they? They're going to take what they can from the sport, and then they're going to go. So they're not about to restructure the finances of the sport. There's no one out there to do it. So the only way it can go is for it to collapse, which it the way things are going, that it might take some time, but surely eventually it's going to.
Well, then the depressing thing is that if, as and when CVC do go, you can see it falling into another bunch of asset strippers who move in afterwards. I mean, I think, to me, the only hope is there are a couple of things on the horizon. One, the fact that the EU is reportedly investigating, you know, the ins and outs of Formula One, which probably was inevitable sooner or later. What was the other thing? No, let me think. What was the other thing?
We'll come back to it.
We will come back to it. Yeah, it'll occur to me.
Instead, we'll put a point that Terry Salmon sends us, which is that sooner or later Bernie's going to be gone, obviously. Just briefly round the table, who would we recommend as a replacement, if anybody?
I was asked this question by Damien just about 10 minutes before I came in.
Oh, good.
And I came up with the name of Zac Brown.
Yep. United Autosports man.
Yeah. But racing background, financial background, somebody that understands the sport, somebody that loves the sport, but is also a great businessman.
I interviewed Zac a couple of years ago for the magazine, and we talked about the whole situation, and you know, he's put himself in the frame as someone who could be a potential Bernie Eccleston type character, although he made the point that he's still a relatively young man. He's got plenty of time on his side, and you know, who really wants to be the next Bernie Eccleston? It's the David Moyes scenario. That you don't really want to follow the big man, or the big little man in our case. You want to be the guy after David Moyes coming in. And you know, I don't know whether Zach's going to be the next guy, but he is the right kind of character. And there's not many obvious people out there who have the business background, the financial success, and the sporting understanding. And it needs to be someone with a sporting understanding and understanding of Grand Prix racing and motor racing as a whole to do this job. You can't just have a Philip Green type character come in. That's not going to work.
I agree with all of that. I mean, I can't really see many people who have Zach's kind of cocktail of, you know, understanding the sport and the commerce. But, I mean, maybe there's somebody out there we don't know, but I can't think of one.
No, I'd agree with that too. Zach's the only name
who, you know,
comes to my mind. Well, you know, who, sure, think of, you know...
Zac Brown, if you're listening.
Well, you know, for those who don't know...
Harry, offer me another name.
Most of the sponsorship deals in Formula One have Zach's hand on them somewhere down the line, you know, most of the big ones anyway, you know, not all of them, but an awful lot of them. So he's a very successful guy in right. There may be other people, but I must admit, I'm starting to struggle to come up with an obvious name.
Robin sends a question in and says, do we really think Caterham will be back next year? And how realistic is it for the Haas Formula One team from America to progress and come in 2016? What do we think about that, guys? Mark?
Caterham won, the odds are stacked against it. It's the levels of finances needed to get the thing up and running and off the ground, which effectively are, you're starting from scratch again. Just enormous. And to do that in such a short period of time, and a team that's been associated with failure, in effect, it's gone. I don't know.
A rich man's hobby, if anything, I guess.
Yeah. As for Haas, I think by the time he comes in, we may be looking at customer cars. In which case, yes, I could see that. But if we're not, he's up against the exact same struggle as Caterham and Marussia.
What must he be thinking? We should track it down, actually, and find out, because why would you want to do it at the stage we're at the moment? I mean, the Caterham business You know, great solid facilities in terms of the hardware they've got, but there's no business proposition. Why would you buy that team? It's what has happened in the past. It will take a very rich egomaniac who just wants to be involved with Formula One, and he'll, you know, someone will come in for a couple of years, it will fail, and they'll disappear, and someone else will come in. You know, that's the scenario we're looking at. Any serious businessman, surely they wouldn't look twice at this business.
I think you just have to look at the fact that the three teams that came in 2010, at the start of 2010, have now all effectively gone. HRT at the end of 2012 and Marussia and Caterham this year. That tells you very, very, very plainly how difficult it is.
And I think they would all say, all three of them, you know, they came into F1 on false pretenses. You know.
Oh, there is, yes, absolutely, yes, absolutely.
They were told there was going to be a cost cap. They were getting at cheapo engines from Cosworth. And on that basis, they said, all right, let's give it a go. If they'd known, you know, how the future was going to turn out, they wouldn't have countenanced it. And as far as Haas is concerned, it's a fascinating one because, you know, Haas is much richer than Bernie. Mm. So if he should choose to, you know, spend his own money and whatever, it would last quite a long time.
He might not be much richer than Bernie if he sets up a Formula One team, though. He might very quickly be less rich than Bernie.
Good. Well, we look forward to talking to Mr. Haas. Great.
You know, remark of Briatore's years ago that's always stuck in my mind. We went to AIDA, I think twice, did we? Yeah. And it was Mr. Tanaka who owned AIDA in the middle of nowhere in Japan. I mean, the Japanese didn't know where it was. It wasn't even considered a big enough circuit to use for Japanese 3000. But the money was right. Mr. Tanaka, you know, paid up. But then we were there the second year, I remember, and I was talking to Flavio, and he said, well, you know, this is it. They won't be back here again. And I said, oh, really? He was that sure? He said, yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, how so? He said, ah, Mr. Tanaka, very rich man. Then he meet Bernie, none also rich.
Yes, good. I like it. Let's move on. Let's move on to Ferrari. Lots to talk about here. Wow, what the hell's going on at Ferrari? I mean, Alonso's leaving, Vettel's coming, Mattiacci's gone now, replaced by Maurizio Arrivabene. How long he'll be Arrivabene for, I don't know. Anyway, Montezemolo's gone, Domenicali's gone, it's all change. And, you know, where's it gone so wrong, Mark?
Went wrong a long time ago and it's finally collapsed. It went wrong when the management there didn't do anything about properly replacing Ross Brawn and John Todt, and just try to run it with Luca De Zemolo having a overview and just sticking his man in. But that man wasn't empowered to direct the team in the way Ross and John had. And it's been on a competitive decline ever since. I mean, it's remained respectable for a long time because a great team, great facilities, they've had great drivers and all those things. But the momentum has just gradually died. And at the same time, we've had, you know, Adrian joining Red Bull and all those things. And so they've not kept up. Simple as that.
How do you and Nigel compare it to, say, you know, 92, 93 Ferrari era, or even 73? Ferrari when they were at the
similar. Similar, certainly it's very similar to the 92-93 era, you know, when the faceless figures of Fiat, and before that, I mean, it was they who got rid of Prost, you know, for daring to criticise his car. So it's not dissimilar. But I mean, I think this year this must be some kind of high watermark, don't you think?
In terms of number of firings, high level firings.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing is, you know, I'm sort of thinking, what you can't get away from the thought that something happened very suddenly with Mattiacci.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Apparently,
the getting in pitch from the company, not just removed from the F1 team.
Yeah, from what little I can gather from the Italian side of things, it perhaps relates to something. Before he took over at the race team.
In the slipstream of all the troubles they've had this year, they've now got Vettel and Raikkonen, who are the two top-line drivers who adapted least well to the current regulations. Is that going to help?
And as everybody's been saying, that you know, the two top liners who were blown away by their teammates this year.
It's an interesting situation. I mean, personally, I've always been a bit of a fan of Ferrari. I suppose it's a romantic thing from being a childhood or something. I don't know. But, I mean, Grand Prix racing needs them, though, doesn't it? Doesn't it, Mark?
Yeah, it needs to be there. But it needs to be a proper vibrant force. And we don't want to see it, you know, back in the doldrums, like, you know, we're just making up the numbers with the red car somewhere in the middle of the field. It needs to be, to carry full value, it needs to be somewhere up the front contending. And, the rebuild, I guess, would have to start from here.
Actually, okay, well, Mr. R. Ruby asks, whatever the strengths and weaknesses were of Domenicali, Mattiacci, whatever, can the company now create a new successful team? Can it be done? And if so, you know, how is it going to be done?
Oddly enough, despite all the catastrophe going on around the outside of it and at the management level, they could just fluke into a good car next year because it's the first of the James Allison cars. And the engine this year, the power unit, was deliberately configured to be small and concentrate on heat rejection for the benefit of aerodynamics. That's turned out not to be the way to go. So there's a big chunk to be easily found there. So they may well have a perfectly respectable car next year and be much more competitive. And, you know, people might assign the wrong reasons to that. But, I could see them having a better season next year, but not because they've changed the management.
And maybe it'll be like Weber said, you know, about Vettel going to Ferrari, but just his luck might go there and they hit a golden period.
Four more world championships. Oh, no.
No, because there's no blown floor. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Gareth Holt says, how much of a mess are they in? I think we've sort of covered that, really. But I think the answer to the question, Gareth, is a big mess, actually.
I think the other thing to consider also is what's happening at the top end of the company with the spin-off of shares. And that, you know, where the future is for Ferrari. At the moment, we don't know who the shareholders are going to be and how those shareholders will view Formula One, especially if the team isn't performing. And it's probably the most uncertain time the team's had since the mid-60s, I'd say. So it's Vettel's coming in a fascinating era.
Well, something I read yesterday, and I know not whether it's true, but just Tuesday morning in Abu Dhabi, when Vettel made his first appearance in the Ferrari pit, the suggestion is he was stunned to learn about Mattiacci, and nobody had thought to tell him beforehand. If that's the case, I mean, that's a great start, isn't it?
There's a similar situation earlier in the year when Andy Cowell and Adrian Newey were both negotiating with Domenicali, and then all of a sudden Domenicali wasn't there, and no one had told them, and it was at that point they both said, you know what, I don't think so. And so that had carry on.
Okay, let's move on to another great topic. One of the topics of the year, actually, I reckon, is Ricciardo being faster almost always than Vettel. Why is this? Dare we suggest it's because Vettel isn't as good as we thought, or is Ricciardo really, really a great driver? What are your feelings about this?
I think Ricciardo is exceptionally good. I don't think there's any question of that now. We could see how fast he was before, but we didn't know how well he raced. But some of his overtaking moves this year have just been fantastic.
Great to watch.
That one he pulled on Alonso at Austin, just fantastic. The dummy around the outside, and the two at the top of the S's at Suzuka and the two Williams, it's just fabulous. So he's faster, not by much, but as you say, nearly always. And he makes his tyres last longer. So he's gone faster and making the tyres last longer. When you watch them in action on the track, you can sort of see why. He drives the car very much like Jensen. It's beautifully smooth, high momentum, just not upsetting the car at all, while Seb looks to still be trying to drive it like a blown diffuser car with a very aggressive turn in. and before you could stop the the bad consequences of that just by standing on the throttle, which you can't now. The slide continues and you lose more time than you gained.
But he's kind of in the habit of it.
He seems to be, and that's the surprising thing. It's not so much that he didn't immediately adapt to these new cars when he'd been so used to blunt diffuser cars. That's not so surprising. It's the fact that someone that's shown himself to be so adaptable before didn't adapt. And I don't know. It's to me is the biggest puzzle of the season. But I don't think we can. I don't really see that he was that it devalues what he did in those cars. I think he was absolutely ace at getting the maximum out of those cars, at the blunt diffuser car. But he was very special at that. But any time when the regulations took that away, and they did briefly, and then it came back, he looked ordinary then as well, and quite frequently Mark Webber used to have the edge on him then. But as soon as they got it back, then he'd be exceptionally fast again.
Yeah, and in fact, before the season started, that was just something Mark quietly said to me, that he said, "I'm telling you, he doesn't like the car moving around very much." And he said, "That's going to be the fascinating thing."
He doesn't want my car then.
and that was why. And he said, in terms of qualifying, he said it'll be 50-50 with him and Danny. And that really surprised me at the time. But I think even Mark didn't reckon that Ricciardo would be so much better in the races too.
I mean, he hardly made a mistake, Danny, all year. I mean, practice accident to Suzuka, but he barely made a mistake worth the name. And it was just fantastic.
Great thing of the season, I think. And he's such a good guy for the public and the sport, and isn't he? You know, I mean.
Yeah, you wonder that smiley, effervescent front that he has. You wonder what that does to Seb as well, because even when he's had a terrible day, even when he's thrown out of second place at Melbourne, or the wheel fell off of the pit stop at Malaysia, or he has the crash in Japan, he just hops out and he's still got a big grin on his face, and you must be thinking, well, how does that work then?
I always look at him and I think, whatever you're on, mate, I want some.
The only thing he did all year long that concerned me was this experimentation with facial hair in Austin.
Yeah,
I was very glad to see that dispensed with after one weekend.
I saw him arrive in the paddock with that and with the big Stetson on. And it did sort of look like 1972, 73.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, it's not. Absolutely not.
I think Martin Tomlinson, we've answered Martin Tomlinson's question. But anyway, because he wanted to know all the answers to all the things we've just been talking about. You know, has Vettel lost his mojo, or is Ricciardo brilliant? Well, that's basically the gist of Martin's question, so I hope we answered it for you, Martin. Tom Power says, now we've seen Ricciardo thrash Vettel, how do we rank him, that's Ricciardo, against Fernando and Hamilton?
He's right up there. I mean, I've done a top 10 in the magazine. They're the three drivers at the top. I won't tell you what order you have to buy the magazine, but absolutely.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. I mean, for so many, the last few years certainly we've talked about Lewis, Fernando, and Sebastian as the three. You know, the in MotoGP speak, the aliens. But I think you're right. I mean, in my head now, you're right. Ricciardo has replaced Vettel in that third slot.
I guess we're now wondering in the post New Year at Red Bull whether he'll have the car to take it to Mercedes. You know, that's the biggest question. There's no question over him.
And or the engine.
Well, yeah.
Okay. That's sure actually how phenomenally good that car has been, isn't it?
Yeah.
With that horsepower deficit, still the things it's managed to do this year.
You know,
absolutely. I mean, nothing else with the Mercedes engine. All right, I know Williams have vaguely threatened Mercedes a couple of times, Austria and on the other weekend. But the only car that actually has beaten them, has won races, is a Red Bull. And you think it had, whatever it is, 70, 80 horsepower.
Yeah. Now, Mercedes know they have their own GPS and they can follow the speeds around. They know how good that car is.
Yeah.
They were very, very worried that Renault would get attacked together.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Barcelona was the big litmus test, you know, where all the problems had been fixed with the car, and everybody was pretty nervous about that.
I tell you, as a long-time Renault driver, I've always known Mercs are quicker. it's very depressing. It's a money thing, apparently. Anyway.
You never had a GTA V6 Turbo, did you?
Sorry? Who do we think, Mike Hamilton wants to know, who do we think is the best of the new guard? Ricciardo, Bottas or Kvyat?
At the moment, definitely Daniel. I mean, he's the full package now. The other two are still evolving, I think. Both great potential. Kvyat's exciting to watch. Yeah. He's very when he saw the his brake disc failure as he approached Redofilio, and he caught a 210-mile-an-hour slide, not once but twice, yeah, and then just continued to finish the lap just because it was the last lap without the brake disc. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty thrilling, actually, wasn't it? And he's awake, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit too soon to know with Kvyat, though, isn't it? Because we just haven't really seen. I mean, in the Toro Rosso, it kind of masks a lot of things, as with Danny Ricciardo.
Yeah.
But the boy can drive.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely.
But can Bottas, too. I mean, you can see Bottas getting there, can't you? Absolutely can.
He always reminds me a little bit of Mika Hakkinen.
He does me, very much. In manner. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, interesting. Tony Guerin wants to know whether Adrian Newey's absence from Red Bull is going to diminish their competitiveness in 2015. What do we think, Mark? No more Newey? Or how much Newey is there going to be? That's the thing.
Yeah, I think that is the thing. I think there's going to be probably more Newey than Newey realises. I think it's probably going to pull him straight back in. The stories I'm hearing of what he's been trying to find out from exhaust flows of other cars, and that's not somebody that's thinking I've parked F1 and I'm going to do something else. He is doing something else. There is another project within Red Bull, which is outlined in the season review in the magazine. But he will be pulled back to F1, I'm sure. And I think that's what Christian's thinking as well. I think Christian's played a blinder there in putting together a package that stopped him going to Ferrari, gravity will just pull him back in. I'm pretty sure.
I think the important detail as well there is not just the fact that Adrian will be involved with Red Bull, but the fact that he's not involved with anybody else.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, that's the. That's money well spent in itself. That was what Whitmarsh used to say about Alonso. If you've got him, not only have you got him, you haven't got him against you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Martin always used to go on about, forget the sort of bravura performance for what it is. Go to the end of the season and tot up the points and then wait for the check from Bernie. And then you see how much the drivers, contributed.
Yeah. But do we think he's going to be very involved in the America's Cup sailing?
No, that's not what I'm hearing, no.
No, okay. Let's talk about Williams. I mean, we're all old enough, aren't we, to have been in... Well, we all love Williams. How can you not? We've been watching them and talking with them for decades and decades. How did they get back from what was just the pits? I mean, really... What were the main elements of that, do you think, Mark?
A Mercedes engine, first of all.
Yeah.
So straight away you've got a big advantage over the Ferrari and Red Bull straight away there. But not just that. It'd be unfair to say it's just that. I think it's Pat Simmons has pulled together. Not really much staff change. Pretty much the same people that were there when they had the appalling season. It's just pulled them together and got them working better. And I think on the operational side, recruitment of Rob Smedley has helped and make that link between what Pat's doing and what's happening at the track. I think it's just functioning now as a proper racing team, and it's got a rocket ship in the back of it.
Yeah, but the car looks good though, doesn't it?
I mean, the car's good. It's not a Mercedes
W05.
Thick end of a second away from that, perhaps. And if there were lots of equivalent horsepower cars, that you'd imagine that second would be filled with other cars, but even so, it's an awful lot better than what we've seen.
Do we think they should have won a race this year?
I think they should probably have won in Montreal and possibly at a push Austria. I think had they been a little more tactically brave in Montreal, Massa would probably could have won that race. Yeah.
Is there an element there though of when you've been off the pace for as long as they were? you've got to, it's not just the car, you've got to get back into that whole...
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, it is. And I mean, there are people there that have never experienced that as well, that are, you know, now making decisions. So, yeah, that's very true.
I think Pat alluded to it during the year, didn't he, being match fit in terms of being that winning mentality. It's not... It doesn't just come easily. You've got to practice, haven't you, to get back into the frame.
You've got to get used to it.
Mm. Yeah.
But, you know, you look at their budget. McLaren had the Mercedes engine too. But they didn't get anywhere near Williams.
Sure.
So, I mean, that's been really gratifying aspect of 2014, I think. Because I hated to see Williams sort of scoring 5 points.
There's been
two
feel-good stories, and Ricciardo's one and Williams is the other.
Yeah, good. Well, we like those because there's so much other crap going on, isn't there? Just throw this in while we're not talking about it, actually, because Marty D wants to know about Hülkenberg, because what Marty's saying is that some of us around this table, in particular Mr. Roebuck, have been saying how good Hülkenberg is for a long time. Has he had his day? Has he had his moment? Shouldn't he have stepped up by now if he was going to step up?
Possibly. I mean, he's not actually has quite such a sort of stellar season as 2013, I think. I mean, there have been times when he's been... It sort of bothers me that, you know, when Perez has been quicker than him, because
exactly.
It shouldn't happen. But I'm fundamentally a believer in Hülkenberg. But his time may be past. In terms of maybe he had one shot of getting into that Ferrari, or you know, one shot of getting into a top team, and maybe it has gone.
He hasn't looked that much better than Perez, really, though, has he?
He's been quicker than Perez overall. Where Perez has scored has been those tracks where the tyre wear is marginal. He's very, very good at looking after the tyres, and Nico is very hard on the rear tyres. It's just the way he drives. He's very aggressive with the car. And so you've seen in races, in those type of races, Perez emerges ahead and sometimes even can do strategies that Hülkenberg just can't do because his tyres are... But he's usually quicker. I think the opportunity of getting in a top team may have passed by, because it's all to do with momentum and perception. And had he got, you know, the top drive, I'm sure he would have been winning Grand Prix by now. But it's difficult to see where the slot's going to open up.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about youth. There's not many young people around this table, but anyway, we can still talk about them, because that's another story of the year, isn't it? Max Verstappen, Daniel Kvyat, we've already talked about him. Lots of very young chaps being out there this week in the Abu Dhabi. What's the feeling about this, Mark, in the sense that, you know, could you go and do this at 12, 13? Interestingly, I was watching some children playing the Gran Turismo, and they have a Goodwood Festival of Speed hill climb on there. Yeah. And some of those guys are super, super good at that. Mm. And, you know, is there some correlation here?
Yeah, there may
well
be.
I mean, Goodwood and the, I'm talking about the skill.
I'm sure there's part of it correlates, but there's a big part, you know, just you don't get on a screen. But in terms of what the these kids have been racing since they're 8 years old, so hundreds and hundreds of races behind them, maybe thousands. It's that we're seeing. We're seeing the effect of that, those kids coming through. Max, very young, but we had 19-year-old Grand Prix drivers with Ricardo Rodriguez, Chris Amon, back in the 60s. Yeah. It's not a teenage Grand Prix driver is not a new thing. It's 50 odd years old, that concept. We're starting to see more of it now.
There's more opportunity thanks to what Red Bull are doing, isn't there, really?
Yeah,
basically,
that's true.
To push more of them on younger. I mean, I used to feel. That there was something wrong when you were washed up at the age of 22, 23 years old, and you were thrown out. But actually, I've talked to Simon about this, and they're given the opportunity so young, and you find out pretty quickly what they're made of. You know, someone like Alguersuari and Buemi, who's, you know, now a sports car world champion, but, you know, they had opportunities and they didn't. It's harsh, but they didn't take the opportunity to show that they were going to be a top liner.
And between the two of them, when they got flicked from Formula One, they'd done something like 97 Grand Prix with a collective age of 43 or 44. I mean, it is very young, but as you say, it wasn't though they hadn't been given the chance, and Red Bull had paid their way through the junior categories as well. So, you know, fantastic opportunity. And it's a hard world. It's a hard world at the top, a very hard world.
I guess the biggest concern is something like the Bianchi tragedy. If you've got a teenage Grand Prix driver and that happens to him, it's the fallout of that, the publicity from that, which then creates a problem. You know, the reality is that was a complete and utter awful fluke that could have happened to anyone. And as Mark says, these kids are hugely experienced, more experienced than any other generation of racing driver because of what they're doing in karting.
Isn't there a sort of unspoken question here, though, in the sense that some people might think, hang on, this is Grand Prix racing. This is the absolute pinnacle. Surely a guy of 17 shouldn't be able to come in and do really quick times in a Grand Prix car. Is that just terribly old-fashioned thinking?
I think if you're quick and the basic core skills will easily be there by
enough,
the time
you're old enough. Sort of.
Yeah, and I think there's an element that the cars are physically easier to drive now because we've reduced the downforce so much. But for all that, people may not like that idea. When we increase the downforce, they don't look as good as they look now, where they're sliding around. So the drivers, the top drivers prefer them to have loads of downforce, and they can really sort the men out from the boys. But to the bystander, when you're watching that, that looks dull.
It does.
This looks much better.
I agree. Completely agree.
You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't have your cake and eat it. Right. You've got to decide what you want.
Yep. Okay. I think we've answered the questions from Rob Morris and Dave Knowles. So Rob and Dave, I hope we have. Dave says, is Kvyat ready for a Red Bull seat? I think we're all agreed he is.
He's still lucky in the sense of finding himself in that car after a year.
Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
From that point of view, he's extraordinarily fortunate. Like Lewis was.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not many people come into Formula One with a car that can win the world championship.
Red Bull's got such Nigel.
No, I totally agree with Mark. I mean, I think he's, you know, he's apart from everything, he's extremely exciting to watch. I mean, he's, you know, he's on it. But he's just lucky to be in that position after a single season.
Yeah, sure.
I was going to say, I mean, Red Bull's got such a roster of young drivers, and it just opportunity. 2 years ago, Antonio Felix da Costa looked like the greatest things in sliced bread after a fantastic season in GP3, F3, winning Macau and Renault 3-5. But there was no vacancy at Toro Rosso. 1 year on, when there was a vacancy, it just had a relatively mediocre season, and they promoted Kvyat instead. And now they've got a collection of drivers and a Toro Rosso seat. Sainz, Gasly, Alex Lynn. They're probably going to put Sainz in there, but, you know, it's just being in the right place at the right time.
It's revolving doors, isn't it?
Mm. I mean, we've had in the last couple of days, you know, Vern is out. What do we think about Vern? I quite liked him as a race driver because he was aggressive and he seemed to make things happen.
I think he's too good to be kicked out of Formula One to me.
Absolutely.
I don't know. You think so?
I do. I can see why Red Bull have thought, no, he's not a potential world champion because, you know, that's what they're looking for. And if they don't think he's a potential world champion, then he's taken up a seat. So, but he definitely deserves his place on the grid. He's a very, very good racing driver, very hard and aggressive. Did a beautiful move in Sochi, one of the few overtaking moves anybody did. But he's out and out qualifying pace is over compared to Daniel this year and Ricciardo the 2 years before that. It's not quite there, is it? So he's had 3 years at it. I think that's fair enough.
Let's move on to the return of Honda. Big talking point, obviously. The car did 3 laps in Abu Dhabi yesterday.
They haven't quite returned yet, have they?
Well, they are returning, yes.
It was a weird thing the other day, getting a press release through my email, and it said McLaren Honda. That sort of sent a little shiver down the spine.
What do we think? Do we think the words McLaren Honda are going to send a shiver down the spines at Brackley and Milton Keynes? And
I think we'll be pretty good, actually. We've heard lots of horror stories about how far behind they are on the engine and stuff like that, but we heard all that. I mean, this time last year, we were hearing that the Mercedes couldn't run for more than 3 minutes without blowing up its electrics and stuff like that. That's just normal development on these hybrid engines. I think I'd be surprised if they didn't come at a pretty good level straight away. As for McLaren, have done two aerodynamically bad cars in a row, but there have been big changes there in personnel. So you'd be hopeful that we can see a decent McLaren chassis as well. I think I've got a feeling that they're gonna figure somewhere. Next
so
year.
Have I, without any knowledge, but I've just got a sneaky feeling. I think Honda are going to want this very badly, aren't they? And they've got Fernando Alonso. Why are McLaren procrastinating why are they keeping us waiting so long to let us know who's going to be driving the other car? And of course, as Brits, we're particularly concerned because of Jenson Button. What's going on there, Nigel? What do you reckon's going on there?
I wish I knew. I really wish I knew.
I mean,
Fernando's deal was done long ago, so that's been set in stone for a while.
Yeah.
And you'd think by now, I mean, we've just come to the end of 19 races this season. You'd think by now things would be fairly easy to assess one way or another.
Monday, aren't they?
I mean, I sort of thought after Abu Dhabi, I thought, well, what more can Magnussen or Jensen do, you know, to sway the thing in their favour? It seems to me extraordinary that if it really is the case that after the last race a decision still hadn't been made, I find it amazing. But on the other hand, then you think, well, what the hell else? Could there be another reason for delaying it? I mean, everybody's known about Alonso for God knows how long.
Sure.
So why not? I mean, it's December. They've said it's going to be December the 1st at the latest after this meeting they have. I mean, that's not normal behaviour from a top team in Formula One, particularly not from McLaren.
I think probably a complicating factor is the fact that Jensen would want to be paid significantly more than Kevin. And they weren't quite sure what sponsorship was coming as a result of Fernando arriving. And there was some that was definitely arriving, and there was some that might be arriving, and it could be that. It could be that they were thinking, well, if we get those, we can pay Jensen what he wants. But if we don't, we might have to say sorry.
It's going to be money, sex or politics, isn't it?
It's going to be.
Well, on the sponsorship side, I mean, it's been the story of the year, isn't it, that, you know, Ron Dennis version 2.0 comes in and tells us in his usual charming way that by the third race of the year we'd know who their title sponsor was and it would all be sorted, and the third race went and disappeared and we got to the end of the season and
more after it. Yeah,
yeah, and SAP McLaren was still without a title sponsor. So
it's probably also worth pointing out that did Jensen score 75 points more than Kevin Magnussen this year? But I mean, that could be worth a couple of places in the Constructors' Championship at the end of a season, and that's tens of millions of dollars. I mean, so it kind of you claw that back. So it's
Okay. Well,
what's the relationship with Ron and Jensen?
It's not as good as it used to be.
No, but it was never very good, was it? Ron's never really.
I don't think Ron's ever really bought into Jensen fully. I don't think he's ever believed in him fully. But Jensen was very enthusiastic about Ron's return at the start of the year. It's just, I think it's soured it a bit since then.
I mean, I guess maybe it's because of the form of the team, but Ron's return, he's been a fairly muted character compared to the Ron that we used to know. It does feel different this time around, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a slightly different role, isn't it? It's more of a an overview in trying to bring the backers in. But, yeah, I'd agree. Maybe it'll be more obviously there when they're successful.
Conversely, you know, you think, well, Eric Boullier is going to earn his money, isn't he? Don't you think?
Yeah.
Well, here's Ron Dennis and here's Fernando Alonso.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they're in the middle.
Yeah.
Is he?
They are two extreme. You probably couldn't think of two more extreme personalities than Ron and Fernando.
No.
And it's going to be fascinating watching that play out again, you know, round two of 2007.
And it seems to me there must have been something. It took long enough, God knows, to get straight. You'd think something must have been done along the way to sort of ensure that they are, as much as possible, kept apart.
I mean, you think back to the end of 2007, none of us would ever have predicted this, would we?
No way. Absolutely not. No.
It's going to be fun.
Funnily enough, a year or so ago, I thought he was going to do that. Because a year or so ago, I mean, I think Martin went four times to Spain to talk to him, Alonso. And at that time, I don't know about you, but at that time, I thought, yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, I think he'll do it. But once
Ron came back,
staged palace coup, I just thought, well, that's the end of that.
It's not going to happen, but yeah.
It's a pragmatic thing, though, surely, because, you know, they've got Honda, they're going to have a new car, they've got Peter Prodromo. They need a really top driver. I mean, the past is the past, I guess, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, they need each other. It's true, they need each other, and that's why they've ended up back together. They wouldn't have chosen to be back together if they didn't need each other.
Sure. Okay. Kevin Joyce wants to know, and this has to be a quick one, if we were Ron Dennis, who would we get to drive alongside Alonso? Mark, your choice.
Jensen, I think he'd be hugely motivated. And when you can give him the car he likes, he can still drive fantastically well.
Yeah, I'd say Jensen. He knows how to handle teammates, and you know he would shrug off the sort of the threat of Alonso. And Jensen's clever in teams as well. He knows how to hold his own. He's no pushover, and we saw at BAR and Honda that he knew how to hustle a team and work them around him. And Alonso wouldn't have it all his own way.
We also saw that when he moved to McLaren in the first place, and it soon stopped looking like Lewis Hamilton's team and started looking like Jenson Button's team very quickly.
Yeah,
very quick. He got everyone on side. But I mean, I think it's a no-brainer for reasons I said before about the likelihood of a whole load more points, particularly for a team that hasn't got a title sponsor, and the financial rewards at the end of the year. I think Jensen's a no-brainer.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting, I mean, all the suggestions are that Alonso wants Jensen in the other car. And, of course, immediately people say, oh, well, he doesn't want Magnussen there because he's very quick, isn't he? He's young, or else he's frightened. I don't think that's that at all. I mean, Alonso reputedly has signed a three-year deal, and he's said it probably isn't going to happen the first year, but I'm looking on this as a long-term project. Jensen is going to progress a new car and engine, I would have thought, much quicker than Kevin.
Well, unanimous.
What do we think of Kevin after the first year? I mean, he started with a third on the road, second after the disqualification of Ricciardo.
He looked exceptional at the start of the year, but just didn't maintain that momentum, really, for whatever reason. Definitely deserves his place in F1, but no evidence yet that he's anything startling. But, you know, people develop in different ways, but that's what we've seen so far. Looks good.
Okay, how about around the table some highlights and sadly some low points of this fantastic season we've just all enjoyed? I mean, obviously, the horrible accident for Jules Bianchi is surely the lowest of the low points. But again, looking forward as opposed to back, Mark, what will we see next year done to try and prevent that ever, ever happening again?
Well, if I've already outlined what they're trying to do, and it's to have a sort of virtual safety car, so that the gaps between the cars and the speeds are automatically controlled. And in that case, I think the essential thing is that you take the decision about how much to slow down and reel out of the driver's hands, and that's manifestly a good idea. How actually they go about it, we're not quite sure yet, because there were a few technical problems when they tried that at the end of the practices in the last few races. But however they do it, I think that's the important thing.
Jim Vitsas wants to ask just briefly. I mean, is this going to hurt? He wonders the purity of Formula One, to have, you know, total control over a full course slowdown.
I don't think so. Really, it's the how much a driver lifts off during a yellow flag period. It's not really, there's no big thrill in that we're seeing.
You know,
it's not adding to anything. Look at variances and who's lifted off how much.
Yeah.
It certainly takes that aspect out of that whole confluence of circumstances that led to that accident.
Problem is, you know, I mean, Grand Prix drivers being the way they are, they're always going to, any yellow, they're always going to get through it as quickly as they can get away. I mean, I can remember Roger Williamson's accident at Zandvoort all those years ago. And, you know, I remember, it was just, it wasn't quite in my sight, but I could see the fire and everything else. But the leaders were going through there, they were barely lifting off.
Yeah, not good.
Even a situation like that. So...
Okay.
They can't help themselves, I'm afraid. It's just it's in the DNA, isn't it? It's bound to be.
Sure.
You shouldn't let the drivers decide how much they have to lift off under yellow, and you shouldn't let the teams decide how the rules are. I think that's the two lessons from this year.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. Does Grand Prix racing, I still like to call me old-fashioned, and does it still get the hairs on the back of our necks standing up these days? Let's have a quick round the table. Does it for you?
It does for me when the cars are on track. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this year's cars, for me, are better than for many years. Mm. Watching them in action and watching them move on, places that they were glued to previously.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. And there's some fantastic drivers out there. It's a very, very good crop of drivers. So, when the cars are running and all the other crap stops, absolutely, yeah.
That's absolutely right.
Damon?
When all the other crap stops. On the track, it's fantastic. In the paddock, it's god-awful.
I think we all get nostalgic about different eras and the ones that we, were drawn to the sport in the first place. But for me, there's still more pros than cons about the actual stuff on the track. It's still Grand Prix racing for me. I know that a lot of our readers this year, we've had an interesting year at motorsport, actually, for the first time that I can remember, we've been out of step with our readers a lot of the time.
Yep.
There's been a lot of cynicism and a lot of unhappiness expressed.
Yep.
And yet we've been writing consistently, Mark and Nigel at the track, that it's a great spectacle. And the whole noise thing has been a constant bugbear that we, I think, collectively haven't really found much of a problem. So it's just everything about the sport at the moment is coming to a head, isn't it? And this is all part of it. It's a really odd time. I think we look back on as an odd time in years to come.
Well, it's an odd time in the world as well. So it's an odd time in the Formula One paddock as well.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what the guys are saying. I think it's still a fabulous, fabulous spectacle. And I'm fairly sure that in 20 or 30 years' time, when we look back, you look at the calibre of the drivers we've got at the moment, or we've had in recent years, Hamilton, Alonso, Vettel, etc., Raikkonen, etc. I think we'll look on back on this as a pretty good time for motor racing. I mean, comparable with Prost, Piquet, Mansell, Senna, or whatever, in terms of the standard at the front of the grid.
Yeah, I agree with that, because I think we did have a period between those two times when there was...
Yeah, it was Michael and Mika.
Exactly.
DC would have an occasional good day, but generally it's Michael and Mika and now tails.
Okay, we'll end on a question from Vinayak Pandey. I hope I've pronounced that right, Vinayak. Next season, is Merck going to run away with it again, or is it going to be a lot more competitive? We've got Honda coming in with McLaren. Presumably Renault will have more power. Presumably Ferrari will have a better car. What are your thoughts, Mark?
In terms of the engines, we're hearing Renault might have 70 horsepower more than it's had this year, which would put it on par with this year's Mercedes. But we're hearing that Mercedes has got 60 horsepower more again. So in engine parity, no, I don't see that. I can see if Honda's done a really good job, I can see them arriving at the level that Mercedes was at this year, so again, a year behind. So I think, therefore, you'd have to be looking at the Mercedes-powered teams to see if they can aerodynamically do what Mercedes did with the W05, and assuming that the works team hasn't made another step again. So you're looking at... you're looking at Williams, but you're then looking at much smaller teams. You're looking at Lotus and Force India. So I would say Williams is the hope, the big hope, for giving Mercedes some competition. Red Bull will do an exceptional car again, as they always do, but I fear they may be behind on engine power just as much as they are this year. And as for Ferrari, similar story, really. I'm sure they'll be a lot better, but Marcus better again.
Okay. Damon, what's your...
I think on the basis of what we know at the moment, what we've seen, you know, if I was a betting man, I guess I'd probably put money on Lewis again, just because he's got the car, he's got the team. He's beaten Rosberg fair and square. As much as I respect and admire Rosberg for what he's actually the good points of his season, he has beaten him well and truly, I think, over the course of the year. And you know, one of the interesting things about this year with the Williams thing was, you know, they confirmed their drivers quite early, and it surprised me that Alonso and Williams wasn't a proposition, you know.
Yeah, but you remember when Pat was in here earlier this year doing a podcast, and I think probably wasn't during the broadcast, but afterwards, I was talking to him about that, and Pat said at the time, "We're not ready for Fernando in 2015. We're just not."
That was halfway through the year, though.
Yeah, I know it was. Yeah. 2016, you know, that might be different. And it was when I said the same to Rob in Austin, he said, "No, Brian, you know, more or less, I'll have him tomorrow."
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think it probably, you know, that was what Lauda said in Canada, you know, thank God Alonso's not in a Williams.
Yeah, because you'd reckon he'd have won those two races.
Yeah.
Montreal and Austria.
Okay, well, thank you very much, guys. Simon?
No, just you asked earlier about highlights and then moved on to something else, so we didn't actually get that far. One of the things, I mean, obviously you touched on the Bianchi accident, which, you know, touched everybody in the sport, and I think it's also worth saying that although people didn't notice Marussia and Caterham, particularly in the results sheets, the human element of both teams will be missed if they don't reappear. I remember Mark and I talking a couple of years ago about if you could create an ideal F1 team, what would you go for? And we agreed that the guys at Marussia are just top-notch racing people, down to earth, no corporate bullshit, nothing. You know, they will be missed in the paddock if they don't reappear, because they're a really, really good bunch of blokes, even if the results might not have reflected as much. And the last thing I'd like to say is, I don't know if anyone heard, 2 days after Abu Dhabi, Radio 5 Live's breakfast programme, and they had Harley Horton, a 9-year-old who's just won the Manchester and Buxton Cadet Karting Championship, in with his dad. Obvious parallel between the young Lewis and Anthony Hamilton. And they chatted to him for a couple of minutes and said, "Would you like to meet Lewis Hamilton?" I said, "Oh, yes, I'd love to do that one day." And said, "Oh, well, you can." And in walked Lewis. And there's a video of it on YouTube, which I encourage anyone to, if you just Google Lewis Hamilton startles young Carter or something. But without any corporate baggage or any of the, you know, PRs ushering him around, it's just natural Lewis on his own, undiluted, in his element, chatting to a young lad about karting. And he was brilliant. He engaged with him completely. It was just lovely with him. And I thought that is what Lewis Hamilton is really like. It's not the bloke you see being run around a TV pen doing 27 interviews, that being answering the same questions,
no, of course not,
just after he's driven 1 hour 40 minutes flat out. And it was just a lovely, lovely thing to see. A lovely way to end the year, I thought.
Good. Well, at the end of this
I thought when you were going to say he's 9 years old, I thought you were going to say he's having a Toro Rosso test next
week. No, he's actually in the car, I think.
Good. Okay. Well, that's a good note to end on. Thank you very much, all of you, to Mark Hughes, to Damien Smith, Simon Aaron, and Nigel Roebuck. And thanks, of course, to Ed Foster, who puts it all together for us. Well done, Ed. Thank you. we'll be back, and we'll be talking to David Brabham. And of course, the name Brabham is very much in the news at the moment. All sorts of exciting plans there, some of which we hope will come to fruition. And of course, Sir Jack passed away this year, so we're much looking forward to speaking to David Brabham. So join us next time. Thank you very much to Alan, who's done the sound for us today, and we'll see you next time. Good. Bye-bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.